All right, I'm going to call this Health, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order. Good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for joining us. I know this is an extra meeting, and it's a lot to ask to have people come and be in another committee hearing on a Friday afternoon after an exceptionally busy week. I don't know about you, but I've been extremely busy this week, and we're getting toward deadlines. This is kind of the nature of the beast, but I appreciate everyone being with us this afternoon. Ms. Dienernhofer, could you please take the roll?
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer. Backer. Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Might be done a little bit sooner. You guys. Oh.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson. Munson. Pryor.
Present.
Quam. Excused. Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right.
Madam Chair, Representative Bracker is late but present.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer.
I got you down.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Very good. Okay, members. So the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from February 24th, which were emailed out to everybody. Is there a member who would care to move the minutes?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to move the minutes for the 24th of February.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bonner. So Representative Bonner moves approval of the minutes of February 24th. And is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if you would unmute yourselves, members. All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, our first bill on the agenda for today is House File 1438, which is my bill. And the first thing I would do is move House File 1438 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And then I have a DE1 amendment, which I would like to move, and then to get the bill in the correct shape that we need to discuss it, and then we'll then we'll talk about that form of the bill. So the DE1 amendment, any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, if you would again unmute yourselves, and all in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? And the DE1 is adopted. So thank you very much, members. So this bill is, as you see, what it does, well, let me back up. The federal government has approved allowing states to pay the Medicare rate instead of the Medicaid rate for administration of the COVID-19 vaccine. So Medicare pays more for the administration of the vaccine than Medicaid pays. And so essentially what the feds have authorized is that if we raise our rate to the Medicare rate, that they will give us the higher match for that. And there's a little more to it than this, but the background of this is that as you know, there's a little more involved with administering the COVID-19 vaccine than there is with, say, your ordinary flu vaccine. Now, we know that we're getting a new vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson, that doesn't have the extremely difficult storage conditions that the others do. But it is for those who are giving it, and I'm thinking in particular of providers like pharmacists who will be helping us get this into people's arms, that it that what we're paying under Medicaid currently doesn't really cover their costs. So this is something we need to do. The reason it's moving separately is that it's really needed to be able to get the vaccines out and into people's arms where they're actually doing some good. So there's a little more complication to this, and I'm probably going to ask for help from DHS. But basically, DHS was wanted to do this, and Senator Benson, who's, as you know, is the chair of the coordinate committee in the Senate, and I were both perfectly fine with them doing this, raising the rate, but it turns out that they did not have the authority to do it, which is why we need to do this with a bill. And we are moving this bill hopefully quickly to get this through so that we can begin paying this enhanced rate. And this should be budget neutral as well. That's a key piece of this. And I wonder if Ms. Durr, who's here to help us out and explain from the pharmacist's point of view, but she may also be able to explain some more about why this is going to be cost neutral. But Ms. Durr, if you can't do that, we'll call on folks from DHS or Mr. Berg. He's here. He could probably actually be the best one to give us that explanation. But just so members understand, the bill is engineered to be cost neutral and to move through quickly. And this is moving in the Senate, and we hope to get this done pretty quickly. So Ms. Durr, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sarah Durr, and I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. My colleague, Laura Schwartzwald, who owns GuidePoint Pharmacies in Brainerd, Minnesota, was supposed to testify today. However, she's unable to be here because she is serving her patients and administering COVID-19 vaccines that they received this week. I'm here to testify on behalf of all Minnesota pharmacy pharmacists, as well as other healthcare providers across Minnesota who are vaccinating patients against COVID-19. The Minnesota Medical Association also agrees with MPHA on this issue. Patient vaccination is one of the many of the critical health services pharmacies provide every day in our communities. There are several pharmacies that are also participating in the Vaccine for Children's program through the Minnesota Department of Health. Since the COVID-19 vaccine became publicly available, patients were assured that they would have a zero out-of-pocket expense. Currently, those that are vaccinating are receiving the vaccine from the federal government at no cost. The second part of the administration of the vaccine is the payment to the healthcare providers for administering the vaccine. As mentioned, COVID-19 administration is a little bit more complicated than the typical flu vaccine, as we have stricter storage requirements and additional steps of completing intake forms and observation post-vaccine. Current Minnesota law specifically defines the reimbursement rate for all vaccine administration of MA beneficiaries, and because of this, MA is limited to a current reimbursement rate of $12.86. Again, as I mentioned, the COVID-19 vaccine does require additional steps beyond what we typically do, and the federal government and CMS recognized this and issued official guidance this past December that recommends states provide the Medicare rate of reimbursement. The current Medicare rate is $16.94 for the first dose in a series vaccine such as Pfizer or Moderna, and it's $28.39 for the second dose of a series vaccine or a single dose such as Johnson & Johnson. Medicare rates take into account the actual costs associated with administering the COVID-19 vaccine, and HF 1438 would put into place the Medicare provider reimbursement rate for MA here in Minnesota. Because of MN's statutory limitations, DHS needs the language to adequately reimburse providers the administration costs. Most states, including all bordering states to Minnesota, have already adopted the Medicare rate for COVID-19 vaccination. On behalf of the healthcare providers administering the COVID-19 vaccine, we thank you for your consideration of this timely and necessary legislation that will ensure a smooth vaccine administration for all Minnesotans. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, Dr. Durr, and I'm sorry I called you Ms. Durr. I didn't realize that you were Dr. Durr, but appreciate that. And so I'm also going to just call on Mr. Berg. It looks like you're ready to give us an explanation of this language. If you have the DE1 in front of you. It's not a very long bill, but it is a little complicated the way it's written. So Mr. Berg, would you please explain to us the fiscal end of this?
Madam Chair, I will, at the risk of muddying the water here, the reason the bill looks like it does is the sequence of events here is slightly more complicated from a fiscal standpoint. So as you mentioned, the Medicare rate is higher. So if we approve the Medicare rate, at this point, there is a cost to doing that, because while we expect that the federal government is going to enact 100% reimbursement for this, they as yet have not done that. That is expected to be part of the new COVID bill. And everyone I've talked to thinks that that will happen, but it has not yet. In the case of the rate, DHS is cautious that it needs to be enacted first, because CMS will not look kindly likely on a retroactive rate increase. So we have to have that in effect now. So if you look at it from today, there's a general fund cost to it, which then the section of your amendment, which was already adopted in the Senate, although there are some date issues to be worked out, but the bulk of this amendment was adopted. It has MMB take some of the COVID, the CRF money that's coming back in, and refinance some costs in the general fund, so that that will negate any actual, there's a general fund cost, then some CRF money comes in this bill to negate that. At the point at which the federal 100% reimbursement goes into effect, at that point, there's no cost, because we expect the feds to pick up 100% of it at that point. But right now we can't look at it that way, because it's not yet law. So that's maybe, it's why these things are complicated. I will be fiscal noting this next week, just to see what because the number that's in that amendment now was based on the November forecast data. There's a new forecast out today, so refiscal note it. But again, it'll come up with a number which will be reimbursed to the general fund out of the CRF, and which ultimately we don't think that even that will matter, because the feds will pay the bill. If that makes sense.
Well, thank you, Mr. Berg. And I think members can see why I needed you to help explain this. So it's been, you know, it's been complicated. The experts have been working on it, but we're working with the Senate, and we all hope to be able to get this increase in the rate out the door to help these providers be actually able to give the vaccine all over the state. And I think, although Dr. Durr didn't talk about it just now, I think we all know that in many parts of the state, your pharmacy is going to be your most accessible healthcare provider. And I think I personally have gotten my flu shots from pharmacies at times, and I've found that to be a very convenient way to do it, even here in Rochester sometimes. And so I'm sure that in all of our communities, there are folks who are really taking advantage of that and will to get the COVID-19 shot if it's available to them. So, with that, are there any questions from members? Yes, Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if this rate will be applicable for fee-for-service, or also will it apply to the managed care?
Oh, that's a great question. Mr. Berg, can you help with that? Or I know that Mr. Greenman is also on the call. Let me call on him for that question. Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. Yeah, I believe this does apply to managed care rates. Actually, what I would like to do is actually defer to somebody else from the department who may be, I think there's a little bit of a complication here. So maybe one of my colleagues from DHS could clarify that.
Yes. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Giogo Hayes with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. To that point, we do assume that the managed care organizations will contemplate including this in their rate structure. As you know, the the rate and fee-for-service, they're not obligated to pay dollar for dollar, so that'll be similar to this. But the fiscal note doesn't assume a cost because we assume that it's contemplated within the rate corridors that already are in place in the managed care organization. So that's why you don't see an additional cost articulated in the fiscal note.
All right, thank you. So thank rate you, corridors, Chair. That word that came up the other day, rate corridors. So thank you for asking that question, Representative Damuth. I can see that you are a good student of what's been going on here because it has not been lost on you that, you know, we say it's this, but it's got all kinds of complications to it. So thank you for
thank
that.
You. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? All right, not seeing any. So with that then, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1438 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So we need to do a roll call on this. So Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would take the roll and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lee Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg. Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam, excused. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. 18 ayes and zero nays.
All right, with 18 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you very much, members. Now we're going to turn to Representative Fisher's bill, House File 1499. And Representative Fisher is going to move that House File 1499 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So, Representative Fisher, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present House File 1499, and thank you to the committee. This is a bill that makes some changes to the drug repository program that was recently established. The tweaks were coming up because as the people were taking a look at it, they found they were interacting with the boards or the repositories that are set up like this in other states, and we're seeing other ways that this could be done more efficiently and still accomplish and do a better job of serving people. So the changes we have here reflect that. The repository relies heavily on volunteers to help make it work. It's currently funded by a grant from the Bush Foundation for the next couple of years. I do have a testifier with me today, Ms. Rowan Mahone, who is overseeing and very involved with the repository. And I would like to turn it over to her.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fisher. And I don't know if I see her yet.
She is on.
Okay. Welcome. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please say your name and tell us who you're affiliated with, and then please go ahead.
Yes, my name is Rowan Mann. I am the executive director of Roundtable RX, which is the medication repository. I have spoken to this committee before, back when we were getting the legislation through to allow this program to exist. We've made a lot of progress since then. We have been receiving meds for the last few weeks. We've already received over $80,000 worth of meds, and we should be giving out medications to the patients in the next few weeks. So really exciting stuff. But as we've been doing that, we did have some little tweaks that we wanted to make to the bill. Just as we were becoming more operationalized, we realized some tiny things. I'm just going to go over them really quickly just so we're all on the same page. We are asking that we can receive over-the-counter medications instead of just legend medications. We do think that this would be beneficial to the patients. We asked, instead of having 5-year documentation, to have 2 years of documentation that matches with everything else in the Chapter 151, which is the chapter this lives in. We asked to remove a section where it specified where in the process we had to do safety checks. It still states that we have to do safety checks before the medications leave the our facilities. No patient, no facility could receive medications that we did not do a safety check on. It just gives us a little bit more flexibility where we would do that. And then we had the final section where we have asked that we can work with other state repositories, especially as we get going. They have some medications that we might just not have in stock yet that they could send to us, and they've offered to. And we're going to have a lot of certain medications that we might not be able to give to everybody else, just because we won't have the patient population yet, that we could send to them and they could. It is very clearly stated that if there's any resident of Minnesota that could receive any of these medications, they receive them, not other states. But having that, being able to work with other states could be really helpful. Are there any questions?
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Mann. Appreciate that. And are there questions? So staff reminded me that that Representative Fisher is not on this committee, so I am the maker of the motion. Okay, we'll just make that correction right now so that I will move it on behalf of Representative Fisher, who's on another committee with me, so I always forget that he's not a member here. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question or two for Ms. Mahan. First question I had was, what are the largest sources that you receive medications from?
Ms. Mann? Is it, could I just, it's Mann, am I right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yes. Right now we are working with a long-term care pharmacy that is sending us most of the medications. We can also work with long-term care facilities.
Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair, thank you. And yeah, that was kind of the, I was wondering if long care was, is it just one pharmacy or is it multiple long care centers? I just have realized that there seem to be a lot of medications thrown out at those centers. And I was just curious if they were taking advantage of this program, because when this program first came up, I was a big supporter because I saw all the waste there. So
yeah.
Good to hear that. And then I guess the other question is, who are your major customers for these drugs? Who contacts you in seeking these drugs?
Ms. Mann.
Yes. Right now, we only have a partnership officially with one pharmacy, which we did do on purpose because we didn't want to begin receiving so many medications that we couldn't handle the safety checks while we just were working through these new processes. But we are working, we have at least two other sites that we're working on that could begin donating, and then we have contacts that we can reach out once we get those steps smoothed out. We just had paperwork signed with the Cook Clinic. They work at the university. So they will begin ordering medications from us very shortly. We also are working with, there are some healthcare systems that we are in the process of trying to get some paperwork signed so that we can begin sending them medications. And we are working with, we're also in the process of trying to get more federally qualified healthcare centers signed up.
Representative Chairman?
Thank you. Thank you for those answers. I really appreciate this. I think this is a really good program. And, you know, if we can reuse these medications, which are expensive, that helps everybody. So appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Keel.
Thank you. Madam Chair. Good to see you, Rowan McMahon. if members don't know, Rowan came to my office and asked if we could even do this bill. And so we've been watching this for, 4 years now at least? Yeah. I was going to ask some of what Representative Bierman did, but it sounds like things are going well. I'm glad to see this is successful and that you are working at helping people to receive their prescription medicines with some reduction in cost and just not wasteful either. So glad to see that this is improving and glad to see you and wish you much success. So thank you, Ms. Chair, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keel. And I should just say to your point, Representative Keel, many of us do know Ms. Mann because she is one of these citizen advocates extraordinaire. She has been in probably every one of our offices, and she's a pretty tireless advocate for this program. And Ms. Mann, could I just ask you, are you now Dr. Mann? You are.
Yeah.
You are, yes. Yeah.
I've graduated, I've passed all the exams. I'm a licensed pharmacist now.
So. All right. So does that make you Dr. Mann? It does, right?
Technically, but okay. Ms. Mann is just fine.
All right. Very good. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I too am a fan of this bill and have been for a while. I did have a little bit of a question, and you alluded to the first part of it was, you know, where you were able to collect donations, and it sounds like you're looking at additional avenues to do that as you expand and explore. The one question that I did have, though, you mentioned that you were working with other states to sort of do an exchange of sorts, and I'm curious from a statutorial standpoint, if everything that we need is in place in either current statute or in the bill to make sure that we can facilitate that exchange between the states.
Yeah, Ms. Mann, I was thinking about that similarly, and just to kind of add to the question, I was concerned whether there might be any federal barriers to sending pharmaceuticals between you and a similar organization, and just to make sure that that's all clear, and so there's no impediment to this. Ms. Mann?
From my research, there shouldn't be any impediments. The language that we've added into this bill states that we can do that, and the other repositories have specifically asked to be able to work with us. So, and they can, they've worked with each other, like Iowa and Georgia, I know, can work together sometimes, or maybe even Wyoming, depending on if the need is. So I feel confident in that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for members? All right, not seeing any. And we recognize this is still in its beginning phases. It's great to hear that it's getting off the ground, and it's really a testament to your persistence as a citizen advocate, and also, of course, working on the program and sticking with it. So thank you very much for that. So with that, I will renew my motion on behalf of Chair Fisher that House File 1499 be laid over, and the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So thank you very much, Representative Fisher and Ms. Mann.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee.
So next up, House File 1158, Representative Akam. And Representative Akam is going to move. Let's see, Representative Akam, are you on the committee?
Nope, I'm not on the committee, but I'm here.
You're not on the committee either. Okay. It's too many of these little boxes floating around. So the chair will move on behalf of Representative Akam that House File 1158 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So Representative Akam, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I am here today to present House File 1158, which is a bipartisan bill requiring a temperature monitor for some prescription drugs that are delivered by mail. For many reasons, ranging from convenience to necessity, some medications have started to be delivered by mail rather than the traditional method of being picked up at a local pharmacy. This bill is focused on this change in delivery and stems from my family experience. As some of you may know, my husband lives with multiple sclerosis, and to treat the disease over the years, he's been prescribed several specialty medications. These specialty drugs are often very expensive, sometimes costing tens of thousands of dollars per month. Because these drugs are not widely used, the industry has gone to a direct mailing model for delivery. An issue with this delivery model is that many of these medications have temperature requirements for their stability and efficacy. Throughout the shipping and delivery process in a state like ours, these drugs can be exposed to such a wide range of temperatures. Patients who depend on these prescriptions have no way of knowing if their medications have been damaged by temperature exposure and whether they remain 100% effective. The remedy is an inexpensive temperature tag that can be included in the packaging that will show if it has been exposed to extreme heat or extreme cold. These tags can cost as little as a dollar and are well worth the investment by the shipping pharmacy to ensure that critical and expensive medications are protected. This would give the confidence customers deserve that the medications that have been prescribed to help them is able to give them the full benefit possible. As I considered this bill, I consulted with Dr. Cody Weiberg, who's the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and he is here today to testify on the bill.
All right, thank you, Representative Akam. Dr. Weiberg, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And technically, I can't say that the board members would approve this bill because the board members have not considered this specific bill yet. They'll do that at the March meeting. But what I can say is the board has addressed this issue over quite some time, because we do get complaints from citizens, both in the summer and the winter, that says that their products have been rendered unusable by exposure to temperature extreme. So what I can tell you is I do think that if this does go before the board, I think that they're going to support it based on what we've done in the past, which is we actually adopted a rule in 2011 that goes not quite as far as Representative Akam's bill does, but we already have a rule in place that says when medications are delivered, the pharmacy is supposed to use, it says, appropriate packaging and devices as required by the manufacturer or recommended by the manufacturer or the United States Pharmacopeia. The one difference between our rule and Representative Akam's bill is our rule has this little caveat that says, in the professional judgment of the pharmacist. So in theory, a pharmacist could say, well, I don't think that I really need to do that device, whereas Representative Akam's bill does go beyond that and says, an inappropriate device needs to be in the packaging. And, you know, but based on the fact that the board has gotten complaints, that the board went as far as to adopt the rule that I mentioned, I do believe that when I get to put this before the board at one of its public meetings and ask the board members whether or not they support the bill, I do believe that a majority of the members will probably support the bill.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Weiberg. We appreciate that. And if you could just hang around in case we have any questions from members, it'd be great. Next, we have Michelle Mack. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, PCMA. PCMA represents America's PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers. PCMA appreciates the opportunity to testify in House File 1158. For PCMA and its member companies, the safety and efficacy of mail prescriptions is of utmost importance and is well reflected in the level of precision and planning undertaken by mail service pharmacies in the mailing of prescription drugs, including those with special handling requirements such as hemophilia, HIV, and cystic fibrosis medications. We appreciate Representative Akam bringing this bill forward, and we look forward to working with her on the language and getting a better understanding of the bill's intention. I know that Dr. Weiberg had, you know, spoken to us previous or right before I'm testifying here, but I just wanted to bring some concerns that we have on the bill, because we're just trying to seek some clarification on how wide of the scope that this bill impacts. We're wondering if it's just focusing on a particular segment of pharmacies, and we'd like to understand the reasoning. Also, the path of the prescription drug from manufacturer to patient involves a lot of entities other than a pharmacy, such as manufacturers and drug wholesalers. So we have questions about how those non-pharmacy segments in the supply chain fit into this bill. And then I guess the other question is, we were seeking information on the reasoning why this is being put into statute and not done via board rules. As I previously stated, while we do have concerns and questions, we do look forward to working with Representative Akam on this bill further. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Mack. And, you know, just to say, this bill has been around for a while, even though we didn't give it a hearing. So, you know, I hope that you will connect with the author and have some conversation. I do have a question for you, Ms. Mack, while we wait to see if other members have questions. And that is, if I am sent a drug that is temperature sensitive, and say it's a drug that needs to stay cold, and I get the drug and it isn't, well, it could or could not be cold, and I open up my drug, how am I as a consumer supposed to know whether that drug has lost its efficacy because of temperature fluctuation?
So, Chair Liebling, all of the mail order pharmacies and specialty pharmacies have very high tech and complex software systems. A lot of them, what they'll do is they will look at the temperature before they even package the drug. They look at the temperature of where it's coming from and then where it's going to. And depending upon that temperature will depend on the size of the package, what kind of ice packs go into it. And it is guaranteed, you know, they will look at it and it will be, you know, they will give it a couple days as well. So, you know, and if there's any questions, there's always someone for the patient to call if they have questions about it.
Well, Ms. Mack, as a consumer, how would I even know whether to have a question? I mean, I think your answer is, we do our best, so trust us that we did our best. And as I'm understanding Representative Akam's bill, this is, the consumer is possibly paying thousands of dollars for this drug, and yet they have no way of knowing that it arrived at the temperature or that it's been maintained at the temperature that it needs to be to have any efficacy. So they could be taking a drug that doesn't work, that they've paid thousands of dollars for through no fault of their own, and they have no even way of knowing. So, Representative Akam, I'll turn it back to you, but these are the questions that it raises for me, and I have to say that your answer didn't address that. So, and then I do have some other members. Representative Akam, do you want to comment?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that the point that you made is a very good one, that as the system sits right now, the onus is on the consumer to prove that something has happened when they have no way of being able to tell that when it's delivered to them. And so I think my bill is aimed to protect the consumer who deserves to get the most effective medication that they can. And so I appreciate there were questions about rulemaking versus legislation, and I think that, frankly, we can handle it either way effectively. And so my choice is to do it legislatively. And I do hope that Ms. Mack and I can have a chance to talk after the hearing. I apologize that my schedule was so busy today, but I certainly would be happy to talk to you about your other questions.
All right, Ms. Mack, go ahead.
Chair Liebling, I just wanted to comment. Not only, I know the patients are spending lots of money on this, but our clients who are insurers and employers are also spending lots of money. So, I mean, we need to guarantee that what the patient gets is not only safe, but it has the efficacy that it needs. So I just wanted to add that.
Right. Thank you for that. And it just seems to me that Representative Akam has a really good idea for you there. Representative Munson.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for the bad audio, but my question is to the bill's author. I like this bill for, you know, I know there's been issues with certain drugs, but especially for consumers that are using mail order pharmacies, you know, where you come home and there's a package on your front step in sub-zero weather or in, you know, 100 degree weather. I don't know, as far as like pills and stuff, if there is a maximum temperature for pills, if it's, you know, it has to be kept below 120 degrees, does that mean that we're going to require these devices to be in really every package of every prescription drug, or is it only on liquid stuff, or just a certain series of drugs? And maybe that question was already asked, but the other issue is, if it's not just for the ship directly to consumer drugs, does this also require it when it's being shipped from the manufacturer to the wholesaler? And then if it goes in 10 different directions, is that 10 additional devices that have to be added to each box?
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson. And, you know, I'll start with your last question first. I think that under Minnesota law, we can only impact those things that are within our state. And Dr. Weiberg can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that those interactions or transactions between manufacturer to others outside of our state, we can't impact under commerce clauses. And it looks like Mr. Weiberg has turned on his video, so let's let him fill in my gaps.
Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, representatives, yes, I have not figured out how to raise my hand on Zoom yet, so I turned on my video, hoping to be recognized. That is very possibly correct. One concern that I would have is if we put into state law a requirement that affected the distribution of drugs between manufacturers and wholesalers, much of that distribution would happen entirely outside of the state. And there could be a challenge for that. But the other thing is, in providing technical assistance to Representative Akam, I just looked into this a little bit, and the FDA inspects manufacturers and regulates manufacturers, and they will, states and the FDA both regulate wholesalers, and they are actually very much in tune to the need in the whole distribution chain to keep medications at the right environmental conditions. To answer, if I could, Representative Munson's question, the way that the bill is written, it basically would require the pharmacy to follow the recommendations of the manufacturer or USP. So for most solid oral dosage forms that aren't something like a gel cap, you're not going to see recommendations to have these sort of monitoring devices in it. This is primarily going to affect refrigerated products or other products where temperature extremes could really make a difference to the efficacy of the product.
Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Representative Akam?
Madam Chair, if I may. And I will only say that from my husband, just recently was sent some medication. It is in pill form, and it is intended to be kept at room temperature. And it had sat out it had been brought to Minnesota, and it had been on a truck for days when it was sub-zero and didn't get above zero even during the day. And so actually that was one of those times when he was able to call, talked to the manufacturer, and it wasn't easy to find out what the temperature guidelines were supposed to be or the range that they were in, but he did get them to send him a new prescription. And so it isn't just liquid like we are. I mean, we're all pretty familiar right now with the vaccine and the extreme cold that needs to be kept at, but I do think that it goes into pill form as well as liquid and other kinds of medication.
Okay, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Akam. And I think, Representative Akam, you mentioned that this device that we're discussing here costs around $1. Is that correct?
Representative Akam. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think there's different types of devices. I think they can range in price. I think the least expensive is about $1. And then I think actually another lobbyist reached out to me and we connected by phone yesterday or the day before. And she said they can range in price up to $35 or something, which are a little bit more precise than the less expensive one. But there's a range, I think. At least that's what I've been told.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. And I guess, you know, here's the thing. You know, we talk a lot about, and I think as legislators, we have a really large focus on sort of that people-centered care for our citizens. And I guess my curiosity here is if we can put a device that ensures that security for a consumer for as little as $1 on a prescription that costs several thousand dollars, it seems like a really small cost of doing business. And I'm struggling here a little bit with the earlier testimony on this issue and the resistance to looking into this option, because it seems like such a small item. And, you know, when we factor in the full cost of doing business, it seems silly not to be giving patients that peace of mind for such a low price point.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had one more follow-up question because I like the bill, but as we've been talking about this, and I'm worried about the mail order pharmacies, which have been traditionally the least expensive option for so many people, I would hate to see prescriptions, you know, online posted saying that they're available in all states except Minnesota because they can't, you know, this mail order pharmacy that's out of state doesn't you know, ship with these product with these devices because we're the only state that would have this. So I'm reluctant to vote for this bill, but I'd like to get input and make sure that this would apply to out of state pharmacies sending it to here, or would that also violate the interstate commerce clause? If anybody could answer that.
And just to clarify, Representative Munson, before we get the answer, we're not voting on it today. It's going to be laid over, but Representative Weiberg, Dr. Weiberg, do you want to take that one?
Never will I be Representative Weiberg. Anyway, the difference here is that traditionally the federal government, the FDA, regulates product, but states regulate health professions under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And so the Board of Pharmacy has been empowered by the legislature to do that regulation. And so, yes, we can, in fact, enforce a law like this against out-of-state pharmacies. Every pharmacy that ships into Minnesota needs to be licensed by the board. And for a statute like this, we would expect that to be followed. There are certain circumstances when everything is happening within the other state where we would defer to that state's Board of Pharmacy because that's all happening there. But when it comes to actually shipping the product in and having a statute like this, we would say, yes, this is what the law says. So yes, this is what you have to do. An analogy to this, if you will, or a similar situation is that out-of-state pharmacies that dispense controlled substance prescriptions to Minnesota residents, they do have to report to the Minnesota Prescription Monitoring Program those prescriptions.
Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Not representative. We won't promote you just yet. Any other questions or comments from members? So I have another one, since I think we have just a bit of time here, and I don't know if this is for Representative Akam or maybe for Ms. Mack, but, you know, suppose you do have a very expensive prescription and it arrives and the consumer believes that it's foiled, Who pays for that? Is that the consumer's responsibility, or is that in fact the pharmacy's responsibility to make good on it? I know, Representative Akam, you mentioned that your husband had gotten a replacement, but is that just because out of the goodness of their hearts? Because if it's a very expensive medication, they might just say, well, that's your problem. Prove that it's bad. Is that kind of where we're at,
Representative Akam? Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I will say that, again, the proof is on the consumer to be able to prove that something had been, you know, held improperly. And so it was only because it was received in state on one day and not delivered to our home until several days later. And the temperature during that time, I mean, my husband had to go and prove to them in the weather to be able to make the case that it needed to be replaced. And so I think it isn't always an easy process. And I will say that most people wouldn't even know they needed to do that because it isn't readily available that these have temperature requirements unless you're told to store them in the refrigerator or whatever. And so I think that it's, as you said earlier, I mean, I think this really is a consumer protection bill. And so I don't know if Ms. Mack has anything to.
Yeah, and I would just say that it seems like, you know, let's not forget that ultimately the consumer really bears the risk, whether or not they bear the financial risk, because they're taking the drug and needing that drug, right? And if the drug isn't effective, or I don't know if it could, you know, there could be some other effect from it because of the temperature fluctuation, that of course is on the patient, right? So Ms. Mack, did you want to add something there?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, essentially that is going to be a conversation that the patient will have with the pharmacy that sent out the mail order pharmacy or the specialty pharmacy that sent it out, and they will discuss it. And, you know, that they'll talk about, you know, what does it look like and ask a lot of questions. So I just wanted to bring that.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I mean, if they know to do that, I guess, if they have the wherewithal to do that, I would gather and guess that many patients don't have the smarts and the wherewithal of Representative Akam and her husband to do that. And we know that chronic disease and acute disease strikes often in people who don't have as much wherewithal, have lower incomes and, you know, all kinds of folks. So I don't know, that it does seem like this is an area that needs some reform. So, all right, well, thank you very much, Representative Akam. The bill will be laid over, and I hope that the conversations can continue. And if there's any tweaking of the bill that needs to happen, you know, please let us know. So thank you very much. The bill is laid over. And we'll turn to the other Akam bill then, which is House File 448, and the chair will move that House File 448 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Akam.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 448, which clarifies a prescription drug definition under Section 62J.23, Subdivision 2. I'm bringing this bill forward on behalf of the constituents, as well as many others in Minnesota who are impacted by the current wording of the statute. My constituent, Ms. Weiner, has submitted written testimony for the committee to consider. 2 years ago, this statute was changed and was subsequently signed into law. That bill expanded the definition of what a prescription drug is as defined in this subdivision to include those medications that are administered by infusion. I am with you today to add additional clarity to the statute language to include medications prescribed by a healthcare professional that are administered by injection or other parenteral methods. Parenteral refers to a medication that is administered in a manner other than the digestive system. In the situation of my constituent, Ms. Weiner, she has been prescribed a medication that has helped her condition. On the website of the manufacturer, there is information about a patient support program that states, in accordance with state law, the patient savings program does not reimburse for patients residing in Minnesota and only three other states. The goal of this bill is that all prescription medications be treated the same, regardless of their delivery method of delivery. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Akam. And so I think I and former Representative Mann actually both were working on changing this previously because, again, because of constituent concerns, but I think we might need just a bit of explanation here about the anti-kickback law and why this is barred. And I don't know if I could do that, but can you do that, Representative Akam?
Well, I think maybe not. Okay. I think that I guess I'm not sure what kind of expertise you
okay.
need.
Okay. All right. Maybe Dr. Weiberg, is this something that I could call on you for if just to explain why the anti-kickback law is, or maybe House Research, actually, maybe that would be the, Dr. Weiberg, tell me if this would be better for House Research.
I could attempt to do this more based on my previous position when I worked at the Department of Human Services. So quite some time ago, Congress really decided that there was too much fraud potentially going on in some of the healthcare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and really decided that one way that fraud could occur is if healthcare providers were providing some sort of remuneration, is the term I think that gets used, some sort of something to a potential patient to induce them to get services with that provider. And so that's one part of it. There are also some provisions relating to two providers doing fee splitting and kickbacks and things like that. Maybe just one example, although things have changed since then, is back when I was at DHS in October of the year, I would start getting from grocery stores that had pharmacies, what I always called the turkey question, which was, we have a promotion, so if somebody brings a prescription to us or transfers a prescription, we're going to give them a coupon for a free turkey. Can I do that for people on Medicaid? The answer back then was, well, if anyone needed a turkey, it's probably someone on Medicaid, but no, you can't, because that's providing remuneration to that patient. And so, no, you can't do that. Now, it's changed a little bit because the HHS OIG, I think, has issued some safe harbors where if it's a minimal amount of payments that are being made, it's okay. But if that's the kickback rule we're talking about, then that would be my explanation.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Weiberg. I wonder if, I think this might be Mr. Chun. Are you on, Mr. Chun? And could you, is there any cleanup to that you need to do? If you could just give us I know there's a really simple present day explanation of why we need to do this and why Representative Akam's constituent needs this change in order to use the patient assistance program. Can you give us that brief explanation?
Sure, Madam Chair and members. I think one difference that makes Minnesota a little bit unique is that the underlying law that's being amended states that the federal anti-kickback provisions are being applied to all persons in the state, regardless of whether or not they're covered by a federal health program. Usually, the anti-kickback provisions were geared toward, Medicaid, Medicare, other federal programs. So because of this language in the law, that's why we've passed, the past exemptions that you've mentioned, because some of the non-government programs or the insurers have been nervous about the broader language in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chun. Dr. Weiberg, did you want to add something more?
No.
Oh, okay,
that's
very
okay.
Good.
Yeah.
All right, did that raise any questions for members? Or is that pretty clear? Okay, I don't think anyone has any concerns about that. So, very good. Well, so, Representative Akam, House File 448 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you. Okay, we are up to House File 1410, Representative Morrison, and I know I don't have to move your bill for you, so I'll let you move it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1410 to be laid over.
Yes, thank you.
Possible inclusion.
Yes. Please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me to briefly present one of my bills again to this committee, House File 1410, which would dedicate delinquent tobacco settlement fees to prevention efforts, received a full hearing by this committee on February 8th before it was formally introduced. So it's now introduced, and I'm looking forward to the committee taking official action on it. So during the last hearing, we talked a lot about the harm that commercial tobacco still causes our state and our young people. Just this week, the Minnesota Department of Health released new Minnesota Youth Tobacco Survey data that unfortunately reinforces what we already know. Minnesota's kids are using e-cigarettes at epidemic levels. The survey found that 1 in 5 high schoolers used e-cigarettes in the past month. To make matters worse, more than 70% of youth e-cigarette users are showing signs of nicotine dependence. More Minnesota youth are frequent e-cigarette users, and these products are being used with greater intensity. Couple that with the fact that we're in the middle of a respiratory pandemic and the upcoming end of Clearway, Minnesota, and it's very clear we need to do more to prevent youth tobacco use and treat tobacco addiction. This year, I have several bills that provide this committee and the legislature with options for how to invest additional dollars in these efforts. Each bill has a different funding source, but they each dedicate $15 million annually to tobacco prevention and treatment efforts. House File 1410 would dedicate a portion of funds that Minnesota may recover from cigarette companies that haven't been paying their share of tobacco settlement fees. So to explain this a bit, as part of Minnesota's 1998 tobacco settlement, companies agreed to pay fees to the state in perpetuity. However, in 2015, there was an industry merger which resulted in the transfer of some large cigarette brands. Since then, these companies have not paid their share of settlement payments. The state of Minnesota is suing to recover these commitments, and the parties are in settlement negotiations. When and if these overdue payments come into the state, we should use them for tobacco prevention and treatment. That investment will pay dividends by lowering smoking rates, preventing youth addiction, and easing health disparities. With that kind of investment, we all win. So thank you for officially hearing this bill, and I look forward to working with you all to find a solution to the tobacco prevention funding gap. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Morrison. And as Representative Morrison stated, this bill was, it did get a full hearing before we had actual possession of the bill. So we have possession of the bill now, and so not seeing any questions. So the bill will be laid over, is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison, for presenting your bill again. That's the second time. This is such an important topic. So thank you very much. So members, we are ahead of schedule, which is great since it is still late Friday afternoon. I'm sure everybody can use a few extra minutes back in their day. And just to note that on Monday, we're hearing a number of bills. We're hearing 1419, which is a grant to help with the very important issue of awareness of skin lightening creams that contain mercury. Representative Morrison has a couple of bills that are up, one about injectable drugs, one about recuperative health homes. And Representative Bierman has a bill about copays for prescriptions. So with that, members, there being no other business today, we are adjourned.